Thank you so much for coming out on 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, and thank you for the invitation to come. This is definitely research that's in progress, so I'm sorry for its embryonic form. In some sense, I've been doing some work on this, but the flip side of this is your feedback will definitely become incorporated into the work, and so I really appreciate listening to you and hearing your comments. As many of you may know, America is an enchanted place. And by enchanted, I mean we see a lot of different kinds of magical beliefs in the United States. When I started doing research on conspiracy theories in 2006, I had some extra room on a survey, and I had run into some conspiracy theorists, and I was wondering how common was this sort of sentiment in the United States. And I threw these questions on kind of as an afterthought and got back some huge numbers, which then I've subsequently done in some other surveys, and we find that Americans really like conspiracy theories. If you ask them about different types of conspiracy theories, you typically have very high percentages of agreement with, you know, any variety of conspiracy theories across the ideological spectrum. Americans also are a very supernaturally oriented people. Very high percentages believe in angels, believe in Satan, believe in heaven. A lot have paranormal beliefs, such as in UFOs, ESP, and in ghosts. We see very large percentages agreeing in these phenomena. Americans are not really high on science. As you can sort of see, under 50% actually believe in Darwinian evolution. Large percentages think vaccines cause autism. Roughly 40% thinks dinosaurs and humans coexisted. In 2012 on a survey, about 53% deny man-made global warming. I just recently did a survey, and I'll be talking about some of those results today. Those numbers have gone up now. 63% say that they actually believe in global warming. So we might be actually seeing some shift in American public opinion on this particular question. Nevertheless, what we sort of see here is a very high coincidence of conspiracy theory, paranormal, supernatural belief, and rejection or hostility to science, or at least scientific consensus. So the question is, what is going on? As Max Weber sort of said, what is going on? He sort of famously noted that we were supposed to be disenchanted. Science, the Enlightenment, was supposed to displace this kind of supernatural belief. Or as my political science colleague, sort of John Zoller, which famously scratched his head, is, aren't we supposed to be following elite cues? And as a political scientist, it's actually very difficult for us with our existing models to make sense of these kinds of findings. Political scientists tend to see the world through a post-Enlightenment perspective. And what that basically means is we actually think most people think the way we do, which is that we hold general principles. From these general principles, we sort of make deductions about sort of what are logical outcomes, and then these deductions then constrain our opinions about particular kinds of beliefs. And it's all very Kantian, and it's all very rational, and it's very well ordered. And basically in our models, people who are not subscribing to this, they're supposed to have these ideologies, they're supposed to subscribe to being liberal or conservative or communist or environmentalist or whatever, and deduce these principles from that. And if they don't, well, we just kind of think, well, they're kind of random or irrational. And we sort of scratch our heads a little bit, and we sort of then move on our way, and we sort of relegate them to the error term. And the problem is that most Americans probably don't think like this at all. In fact, more Americans probably see the world like something like this. And what I mean by this, in mythic terms, a struggle in dichotomous terms between good and evil, a Manichaean worldview that's very much informed by supernatural belief, and, you know, hosted by a lot of superstitions. I'm going to give you an example of this. This is Linda Kelly. She's a lifelong friend. Linda at first stretch looks like the kind of liberal one might find in Berkeley, California. You talk to her and she really likes natural foods. She really advocates for homeschooling. She avoids vaccines. She supports bank regulation. She's very suspicious of the wealthy. She wants to expand Medicare. Seems like very good liberal values. But if you talk to her a little bit more, you'll find out that Linda's also a Tea Party activist. She's a born-again Christian. She thinks Barack Obama faked his birth certificate. She hates Obamacare, even though she wants to expand Medicare. She denies that climate change is going on. We were talking about yesterday about sort of inconsistency in belief systems. Linda is, you know, if you press her on it, it's just she's frustrating to talk to you because there seem to be all of these inconsistencies. And the funny thing about Linda is she's actually quite sanguine with these inconsistencies. And when I asked her about it, she said, well, the difference between you and me is you believe in reason and I believe in the Bible. Which means that when she first told me this, I was like, of course, you're unreasonable. You know, I was explaining my frustration. But really, I realized that she's being very, very prescient here. And that she's sort of saying that she has a worldview. She has an ontology that understands the world. That the Enlightenment has little value or utility for her. She has a very, very different orientation for understanding the world around her. And she is far from alone in the United States. Americans, for example, let's just take the issue of fundamentalism here. We've asked some questions about sort of fundamentalist religious beliefs on a number of our surveys. And yet we get very, very high levels of percentages of agreement. The idea that we are living in end times as foretold by biblical prophecy is generally subscribed to by about 25% of Americans. That many problems can be solved by prayer is usually around 39 to 40% agree with this. That politics is this Manichaean struggle between good and evil, similarly high percentages. That religion should be a greater part of public life, or that Bible is sort of, you know, there's biblical inerrancy as the word of God. You put all these things together in a scale, and it coheres very well. We might call it a fundamentalism scale. And it turns out, this is actually, I'm sorry for all the numbers here, but I just want to show this up briefly. This is an incredibly robust predictor of belief in conspiracy theory. And it depends, it doesn't matter where the conspiracy comes from. It can be the conspiracy theories about the Wall Street crash, about Obama, about 9/11, about vapor trails, that health officials know that vaccines cause autism, that the FDA is withholding natural cures for cancer. And all of these factors, the coefficients that we get for religiosity in terms of explaining the variance in opinion on these conspiracy theories are strong, they're robust, they're consistent, and they far outstrip any of the other kind of typical demographic or political predictors. And so this is when we were first doing research on conspiracy theories, and this was coming out at us, we were really struck by, wow, what is going on here? What could be accounting for this kind of consistency and the robustness of this particular variable? And what I want to suggest is it's magical thinking. And magical thinking is going to be maybe our lens or our foray into understanding what is going on with this portion of America. And what we call Enchanted America is a characterization of is an organization of political beliefs and understanding of the world that has certain characteristics to it. One of which is it tends to resist mainstream scientific explanations. These tend to be transgressive public discourses that are being embraced, that are used to sort of understand the world. Similarly, I think these are opinions that are based more on affect than necessary a kind of deliberative cognition. They tend to prioritize symbolic actions over tangible costs, and I'll explain a little bit more in the talk about that. These are also ways of thinking that rely heavily upon innate heuristics, these kind of mental shortcuts or rules of thumb for sort of making decisions. And finally, these are opinions that are highly constrained by magical beliefs. In Enchanted America, people who subscribe to superstitions or religious beliefs, once they adhere and grasp onto these beliefs, these become sort of information filters by which all new information must pass. So let me try to go and explain how we can go about doing this. And well, I want to start a little bit by talking about what we exactly mean by magical thinking. Now, in academia, I'm using magical thinking in the academic term. Oftentimes, when I'm giving this talk to a public audience, a lay audience will sort of think, well, I have a good luck charm, but magical thinking seems pejorative to them. But so let me try to be a little bit more precise by what exactly we mean here. Magical thinking has two key elements to it. The first is that magical thinking assigns causal attributions to phenomena that cannot be directly observed or verified. So when we're talking about magical thinking, and this is what links conspiracy theories with supernatural thinking, with paranormal thinking, we're really talking about there's some force out there that's causing something to happen that we cannot directly observe that causation going on. Now, there's a lot of science, of course, and scientific theories that postulate invisible or unverifiable forces that are causing things. We can think about like dark matter or dark energy. I think the difference between magical thinking is that magical thinking also must contradict some other prevalent belief about the same phenomena that is subject to some sort of observation and verification. So magical beliefs are not simply about just finding invisible forces, but it's an explanation that somehow or another is transgressive or oppositional to a scientific one. And that's important because if we think about other cultures, for example, that might, you know, have certain supernatural entities that they think are causing droughts or natural phenomena, but if they, you know, we might say, ooh, it's magical thinking, but if they don't have an alternative belief system to compete with that, that might just simply be their science. And I really want to make, you know, make that distinction really clear, that magical thinking must exist as a sort of a transgressive belief system within an existing context. And that's what kind of makes it interesting. So the question is, why do we hold these magical beliefs? Why would someone incur the cost of holding these sort of transgressive ideas? And for this, I'm going to talk about two anthropologists. The first is Bronislaw Malinowski, who, 100 years ago, went and was doing research on magical beliefs in Melanesia. And he had the observation, which I think holds really true, that magical beliefs are tools we use to restore emotional equilibrium. What Malinowski observed when he was with the Trobriand Islanders was that there were certain types of activities where the Trobriand Islanders had lots of magical thinking and certain types of activities that didn't. And what he tended to notice that was that basically magical beliefs happened where there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of emotional instability. For example, when the Trobriand Islanders fished in shallow lagoons and ponds, they didn't use a lot of superstition or magic. They had sort of low risk, low yield fishing there, and it wasn't a big deal. When they went out into the deep ocean, however, like deep ocean fishermen today, they were highly, highly superstitious. And what Malinowski was thinking that we could think about this now in kind of contemporary social psychological terms. Imagine, for example, if our emotions are a set of physiological responses to sort of environmental cues. And most of the time, we have what we might call a homeostatic set point. It's a balanced level in terms of these different physiological levels, and that's our temperament. And our bodies continually seek to return to this. When, however, we see a stimulus, like say, for example, we see a snake, we get activated on certain kinds of these dimensions. These dimensions, and then we give this a label and we call it, say, fear. And so, that sort of excitement, that sort of negativity, that sensitivity to one's surrounding, in combination together, we'll give it a label to. But it's really an emotional and a motivational state. Now, really what our bodies want to do is eliminate that motivational state because that's a place of discomfort. And so what we want to do is get rid of or eliminate the stimulus somehow to bring us back down to our homeostatic set point. What magical thinking basically does is a way of doing that. But we as human beings face a real dilemma, which is a lot of times we face face fear from our own uncertainty, and particularly our ability to imagine our own mortality. We are unique among species in our ability to sort of project into the future and really imagine some time where we may not exist. And so we can have different kinds of uncertainty, and I think I want to differentiate. I think different kinds of uncertainty generate different kinds of magical thinking. There's the acute uncertainty of a circumstance. So for example, in battle, we don't know if a shell is going to come and hit us versus our neighbor, deep sea fishing, gambling, professional sports. These are all contexts where you see high amounts of superstitious behavior, but they're superstitious behaviors that tend to be constrained to those particular circumstances. You know, a baseball player might wear his lucky hat when he's at the bat, but he doesn't wear his lucky hat, for example, when he goes to the supermarket or, you know, when he prays to God. Similarly, then there's the chronic uncertainty. And there's chronic uncertainty, that I said, it comes from our own realization of mortality. And these things dealing with death, mortality, disease, even love. And it's with these circumstances that we tend to have more supernatural or magical belief systems. These are more overarching systems that try to explain all phenomena relative to some magical element. And they tend to be more grossly encompassing, and they have different levels of constraint. But basically, both of these things serve the same function. Here, for example, we're playing cards, we get the same kind of fear stimulus. And magical beliefs are basically what we do to sort of utilize emotional management, to bring our emotions back in line. And they become basically effective tools for us as far as, you know, managing our own sort of motivational states. And what happens is that any type of uncertainty that we get, when we encounter any kind of uncertainty, we utilize these magical beliefs as a mechanism towards this end. All right. So what we expect is that magical thinking should occur under certain circumstances. A, when uncertainty is great, and particularly when B, stakes are high. I don't know if my neighbor's son's going to win his little soccer game today, but I don't really care. I'm not going to have a lot of magical beliefs about that. But if it's me, if my team is playing in the World Series or on deep sea fishing, I'm going to have a lot. All right. Second person who's going to be helpful for us in terms of magical thinking. And this is James Frazier with the Golden Bough. Frazier famously wrote that he collected lots and lots of information about magical belief systems from around the world, tried to bring them together in a compendium, and he kind of made two observations about this. That magical thinking tend to have consistent forms across different cultures. In particular, there seemed to be what we call homeopathic magic or representative magic. And this is basically the idea that objects that resemble one another sort of share the same properties. And this could be most famously represented, like say, for example, as a voodoo doll. I think something that looks like the effigy of something I revere or something I hate will share its particular properties. The second one is contagious magic, which things that have been in contact with things that are either wonderful or terrible will then get those energies or those properties transferred to it. So, we want to touch the hand of a holy person. We want to avoid the taboo place. The interesting thing about Frazier is that reading him, you really see he presages the Nobel-winning work of these two guys, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. They basically sort of recalibrated what he was saying and talked it about as heuristics. These, for those of you who don't know, heuristics are basically these rules of thumb that we use to make assist in decision making. And Kahneman and Tversky found that when we're in the conditions of high uncertainty, we really rely on these heuristics for a lot of our decision making. And they said just as Frazier said, they noticed that there are some of the common heuristics that they identify would be a representativeness heuristic. We think that things that sort of resemble each other share their properties. A contagion heuristic. We too think that things that have been touched by other things share those properties. I think we might add to their list too anthropomorphism, an anthropomorphic heuristic. We tend to think that objects that sort of tend to move in human-like ways must have human-like characteristics so that look kind of human. We see faces in the clouds, or we see, ascribe intentionality to sort of a falling branch or something like that. Similarly, I think what they sort of also notice, the availability heuristic. We tend to, when we make decisions, utilize information that's readily in front of us or available to us, rather than considering the whole possible range of data options that might be, causing a particular phenomenon. What I think is really important about this work, though, this work can really explain a lot of the grammar of magical thinking. It's sort of the logic of biased cognition in this way. And so far as that in this circumstances, our brains are feeling a condition of uncertainty. They're feeling a lot of negative affect as a consequence of that. And they're trying to reduce that negative affect by utilizing a heuristic, trying to figure out what's going on in the most economical manner possible, and they're relying on these types of heuristics. And this is really the grammar of magical thinking. So let me give you an example of this. And these are some experiments that we've run on this. Excuse me. So we show this in one of our surveys, and I'll ask it to all of you. Which of these objects, imagine you're locked in a room, and the evil person who's locked you in the room says, "Aha! One of these objects has the key to the door, and if you get under the key to the door, you will get out of the room, but one of these objects is potentially dangerous, and if you touch it, you will die." They have to speak in that way. Which of these objects would you sort of say, just on your gut reaction, would be the dangerous object to avoid?
Spider-like.
Okay. Which one do you think would probably be the most friendly?
E?
Yeah, most people say the most dangerous is the spider-like. As you can see, that gets 56% of our respondents. 18% see the other jagged one. We tried to make this one look like the edge of a horizon. It might be a cliff, but it didn't really pick up. And as far as the least dangerous, yeah, everybody likes this. For some reason, this seems to be a kind of a friendly shape. Not really sure why that is. But anyway, as you can see, we have these heuristics, things that resemble a potentially venomous spider that have sort of spindly arms. We intuit as somehow or another being negative, even though these are just simply abstract shapes. Another example of this, of how we use these types of heuristics. imagine we asked this in another survey. Suppose a friend said he had won a $5,000 lottery by rubbing his ticket, and half the sample we said on a $1 bill and half the sample we said on a paper napkin. And that we said, imagine you were playing for the lottery. Would you give this a try? And what's interesting is when you tell them a paper napkin, 40% say yes. But if you tell them a $1 bill, 57% say yes. So something about, you know, the object of sort of a representative heuristic, like rubbing the ticket on a dollar bill, seems more meaningful to us than simply just rubbing on some, you know, non-monetary type of object here. And so what we want to say here is about, this is really the logic of magical beliefs. First off, they're really about managing our emotions, especially responses to uncertainty. And in the political and social world, there's lots of uncertainty that gets phrased when certain rare events happen. Terrorist attack, economic crashes, wars. Any number of things generate a lot of apprehension from that uncertainty. And then these palliative beliefs and these narratives that come in also then rely on, they have a grammar to them. They rely on these innate heuristics. Particularly, I think, in a lot of the magical thinking conspiracy theories that we want to talk about, the availability bias, focusing on information that's readily apparent, anthropomorphism, in terms of ascribing human-like characteristics to certain kinds of institutions or other types of entities, the fears of contagion typically are very, very strong here. Once these beliefs are adopted, then they become, as you know, integral to sort of an emotional management system, and they are hard to dislodge. People become very, very attached to them. And then they also become subsequent information filters in terms of confirmation bias down the road. So this is basically our hypothesis about magical thinking and how magical thinking works. Let me see how we're going to try to test it here. But how can we measure these tendencies without looking at mere adherence to particular beliefs? And this is sort of the challenge for us as survey researchers. So what we've been doing over the past year is been doing these nationally representative online surveys. And we just did our fifth one last week, and I'll be showing you some data from these particular surveys. And these are weighted national representative samples. They come from internet-based samples. Our most recent one, we had some people also answering on their smartphones. We haven't really compared the difference between those two yet, but I'm kind of interested to see that as a survey platform. But so I want to acknowledge that, you know, these are surveys. These are highly constrained kind of places of, you know, of exchange of information. We are sort of restricting the answers that people give to the choices that we give them. You know, as representatives, you know, surveys have both strengths and weaknesses as mechanisms for sort of tapping into and understanding public discourse and cultural trends. But what they do provide us with is at least a great generalizability if, in fact, we are sort of constrained in terms of sort of the more micro processes here. So we try to overcome those constraints with sort of clever question designs, and I'll try to go through some of these. So remember, when we're looking at the pillars of magical thinking, what we're really interested in are two aspects, one of which is emotional disequilibria and how people are responding to feelings of apprehension and uncertainty, and then also maybe the susceptibility of people to certain kinds of heuristics. How much they'll really stake a lot of money that figure C, the spiny spider, is the one that's the dangerous one, in other words. So let me explain how do we go about trying to measure these two. One of them, we start with the emotional disequilibrium. And one of them we had is what we call the apprehension scale, or what one of my colleagues calls the noia scale, is in terms of the paranoia scale. And these are a series of questions that ask people about how often they do certain types of apprehensive behaviors. And these are all reasonable behaviors, but do they do them a lot or do they a little? Like, you know, things like checking the locks on your doors and windows, tearing up bills before you throw them away, intentionally locking the cars on your door when you drive, locking your bags at the airport. You can sort of see worrying about getting cancer and these types of things. And we give people a 5-point response option, never, rarely, sometimes, often, neither always or every day. And what we see is that Americans are, in terms of the percent that say often or always, you know, they score somewhere in the, maybe we might say, middly apprehensive. About 50% say they always check the locks on their doors and windows. 60% say they always shred up their bills before they throw them away. Surprisingly, 75% say that they put on a seatbelt right in the back seat of a car. Less worry about sort of diseases or death. Chronically. And we could put these together in a scale. And for those of you who worry about these sorts of things, this is actually a pretty nice scale. It has a nice normal distribution for us. It averages somewhere like in the, close to the middle here. So this is actually going to be a pretty good scale for us in terms of measuring apprehension. Now, at least as far as the things that we think we're measuring. The interesting thing is when we start comparing this, and this is actually our most recent data, look at something like, for example, paranormal beliefs. And these are, the way these beliefs are scaled is people are told, they can actually say they don't agree, they don't know, or they agree. If they say they don't agree, they get a negative one. If they agree, but they don't know, they're scored at zero. And if they agree, they're given a one. And these are sort of different, the percentages across different levels of paranormal beliefs. So we took the paranormal scale here. We divided it up into quintiles. And then we have a little 5-point scale here going from low to high in terms of apprehensive behavior. And what we see is that the likelihood of agreeing with ideas and things like reincarnation, in ESP, in horoscopes, and ghosts, all steadily increases across the apprehension scale. So basically, people who are more like who believe in paranormal phenomena are more likely to report regularly in behaving with these apprehensive behaviors. Similarly, we see a similar with our fundamentalist religiosity items, that people who believe that religion should be a bigger part in public life, who believe in the power of prayer, who see by Manichaean we sort of, you know, politics is ultimately a struggle between good and evil, biblical inerrancy, or that we believe in end times, these things also increase as we move along the apprehension scale. And then support for conspiracy theories also increases amongst the more apprehensive. So here we have some different conspiracy theories asking about fluoride in the water supply, that cell phones cause cancer and public health officials are hiding that up. The birther conspiracy theory about Obama's, that the FDA is suppressing natural cures for cancer, and that, you know, there was a secret plan orchestrating the financial crisis. And once again, we see a very steady relationship across all of these conspiracy theories by apprehension. Another way of measuring sort of emotional disequilibria is what we call the pessimism scale. And we ask people to rate on a 100-point scale how likely they think that in either the coming year or in the next 10 years, the following will occur. The U.S. will have an Ebola outbreak or outbreak of some major infectious disease. A major terrorist attack will occur on U.S. soil. The U.S. economy will enter a recession. The U.S. will go to war with China or Russia. And this goes from, they can go either zero, that's just not going to happen, to 100. At absolute certainty. And on our average score on this is people are less concerned about an Ebola outbreak. They're more apprehensive about terrorist attacks, recessions, and war. And once again, we can put this together in kind of a scale. It has a pretty normal distribution, so we're happy with that as far as our scale properties go. These items are pretty highly correlated with each other as well. And once again, going back, we see this too also, how we increase in terms of our paranormal beliefs tends to increase amongst the paranormal, amongst the pessimism scale, particularly here amongst horoscopes. Interestingly, people believe in horoscopes, you know, you have much bigger differences across horoscope belief and here, but also ghosts, ESP, reincarnation. We see very similar differences in supernatural beliefs on our religiosities. So religious beliefs, the idea that there's an observant God, belief in Satan, the belief that life has a purpose, belief in angels. Our fundamentalist religiosity measures also increase consistently across the pessimism scale. And belief in conspiracy theories and support for conspiracy theories also increase across the pessimism scale as well. So we have two measures we think of sort of emotional disequilibria. They seem to correlate very strongly with a whole range of different kinds of magical beliefs. So at least this is consistent with one of our hypotheses here. Now the second one is, how do we gauge susceptibility to certain kinds of heuristics? And if you can remember, we're looking particularly at heuristics that are contagion heuristics or representativeness heuristics or availability heuristics. And we try to get at this with a sort of novel measure here. So I'll go through and maybe we can just add, as I'm going through this, imagine you're one of our survey respondents. And what we basically do is we're going to give you a set of unusual questions. Can you please give us your gut response to these questions and just tell us what's the one that you immediately comes to mind? We ask people to sort of answer these questions as quickly as they can. And they go as follows. Would you rather A, stab a photograph of your family Or B, stick your hand in a bowl of slimy worms, and sometimes we say cockroaches. Stab, okay.
Neither.
We don't give the neither option. We yell, next, would you rather yell, I hope I die tomorrow out loud 5 times, or ride in a speeding car without a seatbelt?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you rather sleep in laundered pajamas once worn by Charles Manson, or put a nickel in your mouth that you found on the ground? Would you rather grind your shoes into an unmarked grave or stand in line for 3 hours at the DMV? In the States, that's the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's to get your driver's license. And lastly, would you rather spend the night in a luxurious house where a family was recently murdered, or spend the night in a dingy bus station? When we take this to our surveys, we've asked these sets of questions now in 5 different surveys, and the consistency of the responses is remarkable. So basically, we sort of see that 2/3 of people would rather stick their hands in a bowl of slimy worms than stab a photograph of their family. If you move it to cockroaches, it gets more 50-50. So we had to play with these because you had to figure out, okay, what we wanted to get a good balance here in terms of these the symbolic value. And so you see that cockroaches are worth that much more. A few more would probably ride without a seatbelt than be willing to yell, I hope I die tomorrow. About 2/3 would rather put a nickel in their mouth that they found on the ground than sleep in laundered pajamas by Charles Manson. We didn't describe what kind of pajamas they were. People are probably using them. They are laundered. Yeah. About 3/4 would rather stand in line at the DMV than grind their shoes into an unmarked grave. And then about half and half usually split on the grimy bus station of the luxurious house. We wanted to ask one more item to sort of get this here, and we asked on a couple of surveys, we've asked the 6th item. Imagine you were getting a lottery ticket for $500 million. Would you rather buy a lottery ticket from and there are 2 gas stations that were right next to each other, one that had never sold a winning ticket but had no line, or the second one that had sold 2 winning tickets in the past 3 years but had a long line? Here we get a sort of nice difference. At least, 3/4 are willing to go to the winless gas station, but there's still 1/4 that are willing to bear the cost of the line, completely indifferent to the laws of probability. So we can put these together, and once again, here we also get a pretty nice distribution on this scale in terms of symbolic thinking. And what I want to describe here is what we have on the low end of the scale are tangible thinkers. So these are people who basically avoid the tangible costs, the putting the nickel in their mouth, sticking their hand in the bowl of cockroaches. These are sort of the demonstrable, tangible cost. And they really, they'll accept a symbolic cost and they'll take the tangible cost consistently. We see about half the sample really is in between and switches depending on the particular items, moving back and forth. Some items will take tangible costs and some will take symbolic costs. And at the high end of the scale are people who always avoid the symbolic costs and will absorb a tangible cost. Prefer a tangible cost to a symbolic cost.
How do you find people who are prepared to answer those sort of questions?
We pay them.
Okay. That's the only thing I think to make anybody answer those sort of things.
They're costless to answer. We can talk about this a little bit more, but this becomes a question of methodology. But our respondents are compensated for their participation in these surveys. What we see here on this sort of, the older versions, I call this a magical thinking scale. I actually really want to call this a symbolic thinking scale, is that we can go through and start looking at some different supernatural and paranormal beliefs, and we see these two change dramatically across this scale. For example, the percent agreeing with the idea that their life has a specific purpose tends to dramatically increase. I mean, people who are tangible thinkers, fewer than 40% actually would agree with this particular statement, as opposed to symbolic thinkers, where we see over 70% think that their life has a particular purpose. Similarly, if you look at supernatural beliefs, things like heaven, angels, Satan, we see these dramatically increase in terms of the percent agreeing across the magical thinking scale. And once again, these are nearly doubling in their percentages who are agreeing this, and in a pretty linear fashion here. We were pretty struck by these results. Similarly, people reporting supernatural experiences also change across the symbolic thinking scale. People say they have felt the presence from God or received a sign from God, or they actually changed something by praying. The percent saying these things happen to them also tend to double across this particular scale. Once again, our fundamentalist religiosity items, these are at least four of them, they too seem to increase. Our symbolic thinkers tend to be much more likely to subscribe to fundamentalist religious beliefs. Other beliefs, we ask some questions about crystals, homeopathy, ghosts, did humans coexist with dinosaurs? These two, in a slightly less linear pattern, but still nevertheless increase across the symbolic thinking scale. The percent who believe in Darwin's theory of evolution decreases pretty steadily across the symbolic scale. And so let me put this all together, and I'll come to some other things. We have three types of beliefs that were kind of magical beliefs that we're focusing on: conspiracy theories, fundamentalism, and paranormal beliefs. And we have now three measures of magical thinking, symbolic thinking, and our apprehension and pessimism scales. And let me show you how they sort of all work together here. And basically, these are the low, medium, and high values of our scales. And these are right here. And basically, the percent agreeing or disagreeing with religious fundamentalism. And there's remarkable consistency across all three of these measures for religious fundamentalism. Basically, as people become more apprehensive, they become more pessimistic, and they become more symbolic in their thinking, they all are much, much more likely to score in a positive realm in terms of religious fundamentalism. Similarly, in terms of a paranormal belief scale, we too find that, you know, it's interesting, Americans are generally, if you give them the option between agreeing and disagreeing or don't knowing on paranormal beliefs, they tend to be more neutral or agreeing and less negative on whole. But basically, these two also increase as we go up the paranormal belief scale. ESP is a really big one. ESP is an incredibly popular belief amongst the paranormal. And then finally, support from conspiracy theories. This too also occurs in a linear fashion. But basically, as people become more pessimistic, apprehensive, or symbolic in their thinking, they tend to subscribe much more to conspiracy theories. So putting this together, what does this all mean? We take from this a number of implications. But one of the things, what we're really trying to understand here, is why people would subscribe to transgressive beliefs. And particularly, why might they reject the scientific consensus that comes from what elites are telling them? And we suggest that probably it's because a lot of those beliefs that are being told to them don't have a lot of emotional resonance for them. They don't necessarily have a lot of utility for them. Whereas magical beliefs have a utility, and their utility is about emotional management, and it's about making sense of the anxiety and apprehension rationalizing the apprehension and anxiety they feel in a very uncertain world. And so why transgressive beliefs are popular is because they actually serve a kind of functionality to them. Why conspiracy theories in particular may be attractive may also work in this particular way. Particularly if people, for whatever reason, are finding themselves marginalized from elites, are mistrustful from elites. And let me, you know, if you look at, say, our data, we find that where conspiracy theories are most popular are really amongst the most marginalized elements of society, that sort of groups that are, for whatever reason, be it their race, their economic status, or their simply their levels of trust, find themselves kind of on the margins of the social order. These are where conspiracy theories tend to thrive. And for these groups, you can imagine that the world is a very uncertain place. It generates a lot of negative affect for them. And a conspiracy theory as an alternative narrative or explanation for some event would hold maybe some greater intuitive resonance, particularly if the conspiracy theory embodies some of these heuristics that we were talking about, the availability heuristic or representativeness heuristics, which many conspiracy theories do in terms of their own narrative structures. I think in a broader sense, though, what we like about this project is we're hoping to try to figure out a different way of understanding the role of emotions and particularly metaphors in public discourse and political opinion. How people utilize certain types of symbols as a way of understanding the world and interpreting the world through them. And then finally, when we talk about, this was coming up yesterday a little bit and came up in dinner time conversation, why or whether conspiracy theories now are beginning to flourish. And you know, one has to wonder if it's an ironic byproduct of sort of democratization of knowledge is that we now have a crisis of authority. I think back to, say, like, for example, 50 years ago, you know, you would see your doctor, and what your doctor told you was considered, you know, was revered. Your doctor, of course, had a monopoly on knowledge and truth. And, you know, in this time, we've become to question, for example, the medical establishment. We've become to question bankers, the economic establishment, in a very strong way. Question academics, scientists, authorities. And all of this sort of democratic questioning, which in fact is an integral part of the scientific experience, is sort of the questioning of orthodoxy, the relentless questioning of any kind of truth. There generates a lot of uncertainty, and science is really about sort of sitting with uncertainty. And as that has spread, and as that has become in some sense democratized, that has also generated, we might say, a crisis of authority. And in that crisis of authority, where you see these sort of transgressive narratives can take root. And the reason why they may flower and prosper is for people who are trying to understand an uncertain world, for whom, like, you know, conditional probabilities make little intuitive sense and probably just don't resonate at all. It's going to be very hard to sort of talk to someone, you know, who doesn't really get conditional probabilities about sort of scientific outcomes in some ways. And then if you contrast that with some sort of supernatural explanation or a conspiracy narrative, wow, that has a lot more emotional resonance. And so one of the things that I think is interesting about this is trying to understand where the power and the dynamic of these transgressive narratives and how they exist as, in some ways, as a byproduct of a more open dialogue about questioning scientific, religious, or medical or sort of expert opinions. So thank you. I'll open that up for questions now.